Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Tens of thousands of Chinese troops have imposed a tense calm on the capital of the western Xinjiang province. Ethnic riots earlier in the week left at least 156 dead, thousands injured and imprisoned. The violence between Uyghur and Han Chinese mobs forced Chinese President Hu Jintao to cut short an international trip. Joining me in the studio, John Pumphrey of The Washington Post, Chan Li of the Brookings Institution, and Nuri Turkel. He's an attorney and past president of the Uyghur American Association. Throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
John Pumphrey, if I could start with you, what do we know about what set off these riots in the first place?
In late June, there was a clash between Chinese and Uyghur workers at a shoe factory in southern China after some Chinese workers believed that a Chinese woman had been raped by two Uyghurs. That clash ended up with dozens of Uyghurs being hurt and at least two being killed. Now, the Chinese authorities in southern China, according to many Uyghur groups, didn't act as quickly as they should have to deal with the miscreants. And so on July 5th in Xinjiang, in the Xinjiang capital of Urumqi in northwestern China, a group of Uyghur students began to protest, calling for swift action against the Han Chinese who had been allegedly beaten up the Uyghurs. That protest then unraveled. It exploded into basically an orgy of violence on that evening, leaving more than 100 dead and more than 1,000 wounded. Han Chinese in the city then retaliated a couple of days later, roaming the city with bands of Han Chinese carrying clubs looking for Uyghurs to seek vengeance on.
And now we'll go to Wall Street Journal reporter Shai Auster. He's in Urumqi. Good morning to you, Shai. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks.
Can you describe the situation on the streets today?
Well, I'm in the People's Square, which is one of the locations of some of the worst violence, or not far from some of the worst violence. And today, as I look around me, there are families out for evening strolls. The police presence, while still here, is significantly reduced. Instead of riot police in full body armor stationed every few feet, now there are far fewer of them wearing just regular uniforms while still carrying their shields. At least in the Han-dominated part of the city, it's a much calmer feeling. Earlier today, however, I was in one of the more Uyghur, a Uyghur neighborhood, and was in a mosque where they were holding a surreptitious prayer. They had been told not to hold any prayers, but they had decided to go ahead anyway. And there was a few moments of tenseness there. The officials told them to disperse, and people in that neighborhood are still on edge. At one point, there was a rumor going around that Han vigilantes were coming, and everyone, all of a sudden, the clubs materialized hidden behind ditches or poles or wherever. So definitely that neighborhood, parts of it are still tense. But overall, the situation is a world away from where it was Monday or Tuesday when I arrived on Monday.
Accompanying this story, you wrote for today's Wall Street Journal as a photograph of three Uyghur residents setting up a barrier and arming themselves with clubs and knives. Is that still apparent?
Not here where I am. I'm in the Han area. And during the day, wandering around the Uyghur neighborhood, it was clear that they still had the clubs stashed away, easy to grab, but there were no obvious barriers. And also in a lot of the commercial parts of the Uyghur neighborhood, it really was business as usual. The bazaars were back open, not the bazaar rather, but the fruit markets were open. A lot of the restaurants had reopened. It seemed more tense in particularly poor neighborhoods. And a lot of those barricades were set up towards evening. And so now it's nightfall here, about 10 o'clock Beijing time, although Uyghurs will tell you it's actually 8 o'clock Xinjiang time. And so as night falls, I'm sure there are still some places where barricades are being set up because people are still, even though on the surface things have calmed down, I think the nervousness is still there.
We've been told that President Hu Jintao has returned to China, and this morning we are receiving a report from the AP that an urgent 9-member Politburo Standing Committee meeting has been called, and the members and officials at all levels are being mobilized to restore order. Are you seeing troops in the streets?
Am I seeing what? Oh, feet in the street.
Yes.
I saw feet in the street pretty early on. In fact, today there seems to be fewer feet on the street. You know, to give you an example of the police presence, even now that tension's somewhat down, there are two helicopters circling overhead. There is a propaganda truck driving around broadcasting a speech urging residents to remain calm. There are flyers that have been dropped from the air into the Uyghur neighborhoods urging calm, and there are posters hung up in the Han neighborhoods. What more can I say?
I have a question for you, and that is, have your movements been in any way restricted?
I seem to be lucky that way. I got harassed twice. but first let me say, this is, I think, the first time that an incident of violence, as opposed to, for example, the earthquake in Beichuan a year ago, where the government allowed foreign journalists in. Granted, our internet access is limited to 2 rooms in a hotel. Otherwise, the city is completely cut off from the internet. But we were allowed here. On my first day here, first I arrived on Monday night. I walked through many, many checkpoints without any interference at all, surprisingly. Only on the following morning, when I went to one location, where I was searched by a small group of armed police with drawn guns who searched through my bag, grabbed my notebook, made me delete photos. But it ended politely. They just asked me to register. There's actually a center here. They set up a special media center where we registered. Then following a couple hours later, I'd heard there was an incident. Actually, this was an incident that had been widely publicized because it happened during a special government-organized tour for journalists. I rushed up there, and along with a colleague, and we tried to see what had happened, and in the back and forth somehow ended up being detained by police for 3 hours. Again, you know, there was a bit of shoving and pushing in the beginning, but the detention was largely cooling my heels in an air-conditioned office. But since then, and those were very frustrating experiences, but since then, by and large, I've walked around unfettered. Granted, the police presence is here, and particularly among Uyghurs, there's a palpable nervousness about talking to foreign reporters. It's hard to get people's names. And among the Han, you know, they're the majority. They're much more vocal. They're much more willing to give their names. That said, there have been a couple of cases where crowds on both sides have turned ugly against journalists. No one has been hurt, but there's been a couple of close calls. But overall, this has been a remarkable, and I think they took a gamble on this by letting us all come here. I mean, there's about 100 of us, you know, these unruly, scrappy foreign reporters sticking their microphones under everybody's noses at an incredibly sensitive time. By and large, we're able to do our job. It's not easy circumstances. It's getting around the city had been very, very difficult because it's a very large area and there's no there's roadblocks everywhere, so there's a lot of walking around. We cannot dial international calls. We can get international. We can't dial out international. There's still no texting. We can gather the information. It's just a problem of how to get the information back out.
Now, are the people on the street then willing to talk with you about what they see happening, and who are they blaming?
Well, it depends who you ask. This is where the blame falls. Like in any other place, people are willing to talk, except that among the Han, there's always a deep suspicion that the Western media is out to smear the Chinese. Among the Uyghur, there's a fear that if they talk to you, they'll end up in jail. So that kind of puts a cramp in things. But still, people do talk. And both sides agree on one thing, that this all began with a dispute in a factory in the South. But then sort of the underlying causes of where it begins to differ, depending on which Han Chinese you talk to.
Shai Auster, he's with the Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Urumqi in Western China. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You've heard from Shai Auster of the Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Western China. Here in the studio, John Pomfret. He's editor of the Washington Post Outlook section and author of Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates, and the Story of the New China. Chan Li of the Brookings Institution. And Nuri Turkel, he's past president of the Uyghur American Association. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Chan Li, let me ask you about the migration process and what has led to this clash of cultures here in Western China.
Well, because of the market economy, you do see the increasing integration, the migration actually two ways, not just the Han Chinese move to Xinjiang region, but also small number of Uyghurs also move out of Xinjiang and they live in Beijing and other cities, although the number much smaller.
The Uyghurs there in great numbers in that province before this migration of Han?
Well, not many, but now there's increasing, there's some villages, Xinjiang villages, protests in Beijing and elsewhere. But also, Chinese government also deliberately want to move people to Xinjiang and Tibet. Because the reason that they concern about the possible, you know, ethnic separatism, this is what they call. They wanted to make people, Han Chinese, integrated with that region. This is a better way to control. Of course, Chinese government usually deny or you know, so this is not the reason. It's more because of driven by market. But of course, the market economic integration plays a very important role. But the problem is that not only Chinese government believes that this will help Uyghurs and help the economy, but the reality is more complicated. Of course, some people probably benefit, but in many, they thought they are losers because the job competition is very intense. And the Uyghurs believe that they took jobs from us, and also there are a lot of economic problems because Chinese entrepreneurship can sometimes could be very aggressive.
Chan Li, the Brookings Institution, turning to you, Nuri Turkel. Tell us about a woman named Rabia Kadir and why she is being blamed for the unrest that's going on there.
I'd like to quickly comment on Chen Li's point on the migration issue.
Certainly.
Before it started. The Chinese government, by its own admission, acknowledges that the Han Chinese population in Uyghur region was much, much smaller. Just a couple of days ago, New York Times article cited a figure stating in 1949, Han Chinese population in the Uyghur region was only 4%, but in 2000, it reached 40%. Today, in the capital city, the Han Chinese population reached 80%. So that is...
So now the Uyghurs are a minority.
In their own capital city.
I see.
So that is one of the main reasons for the Uyghur resentment. And Chen Li was mentioning one aspect of the Chinese government's purpose to... conduct this vast migration concerning the separatism. But the main reason from Uyghur perspective is to dilute the Uyghur culture by mass migration. The government's migration policy is purposefully designed. They bring lots of migrant workers, college graduates, and take away jobs.
And so why would they wish to dilute the Uyghur population?
The Uyghur region is strategically important to the Chinese state. It borders with eight countries in the Eurasia continent and has a large international border, about 1,000 kilometers. It is a gateway to Europe, and most importantly, it sits in large oil reserve.
I want to get back to the question of Rabia Kadir, but John Pomfret, I know you'd like to add.
When you talk to Chinese about how they perceive of the Uyghurs, especially when they're talking to an American, they almost always frame their activity in Xinjiang in the Northwest as something that's similar or parallels to the white man's activity in the Western United States, where the white man had a quote-unquote civilizing mission. The same for the Chinese. They have a civilizing mission there as well. And that's how they view it. In the early years of this century, they launched a program called the Great Western Development Scheme. And in justifying the need for such a program, which involved the massive influx of lots of investment into Xinjiang and other provinces in the West, they used basically direct quotes from manifest destiny texts from the 19th century in the United States. And so they say, how can you Americans who've had this history with your Native Americans criticize us for doing a similar thing that we need to do in order to create a real country again? And I think that's one of the things that I often hear from Chinese when they try to explain what they're doing. It doesn't play so well to a 21st century ear, but they're saying, you know, you have no right to criticize us when you did the very same things yourself.
Well, that's true. That's the problem. I think Chinese still, you know, have the old idea. They criticize the things we in the United States also criticize, you know, the way we treat the Native Americans and also to a certain extent minority group. But this is a lack of sensitivity in terms of, you know, ethnic issue. It's a problem. This certainly reflects deep-rooted tensions between Han Chinese and also minority group, particularly Tibetans and Uyghurs. Now, Chinese government very quickly, after this event a few days ago, accusing three forces. One is what they call the religious fanaticism. Second is ethnic separatism. And the third is international terrorism. Of course, there's some truism in each of these cases because Xinjiang, as we know, there's some problems, and also there's a valid concern about the so-called East Turkestan Islamic movement, which the United States also considers as a terrorist group. According to Chinese official statistics, between 1990 to 2001, there were about 200 terrorist attacks. This is the number Chinese government released. And in the past few years, but particularly during the Olympics, or before or after, there's a deadly bus explosions in Shanghai and Kunming. But of course, I do not want to link these two things together, because right now it's largely it's ethnic tensions or grievance among the Uyghurs. But from Chinese perspective, they thought that some reasons, that some forces jointly or separately try to overthrow the Chinese, presence in Xinjiang. Now that's the tension. But most importantly, the Chinese public actually now largely Han Chinese, behind the Chinese government. That explains why Chinese government allowed foreign journalists mm-hmm. enter the region. They thought if you criticize China, Chinese public even more supportive for the government. But at the same time, they want to present this is a right, not some kind of legitimate peaceful demonstration.
All right, turning to you, Nuri Turkel, tell us about Rabia Kadir.
Ms. Rabia Kadir is the Uyghur Freedom Movement leader. She's the president of World Uyghur Congress and also president of Washington-based Uyghur American Association. The Chinese government as it did in the past, blaming someone else, outside forces, for their own wrongdoings.
She, I gather, was expelled from China.
In 2005. But she has no connection, no business with what happened in Urumqi. The Chinese government should examine its policies and what they have done in the last six decades to the Uyghur people instead of blaming the outside forces. Let's don't forget, this is the same government blamed the Dalai Lama last year when the Tibetans took to the streets. It's the same scenario, same situation. The Uyghur suffering, if I may add, no different than the Tibetans, but the international community, press, and government's not paying enough attention.
John Pomfret.
Rabia Kadir is a very interesting character. She was quite a very successful businesswoman in China up until the 90s, when there were some ethnic problems in Xinjiang. She criticized them publicly, and then she was removed from her post as a member of a national consultative body. After that, she became a target of the police, and she met with a congressional delegation.
Here in Washington
In Xinjiang. And she passed them newspaper clips. And so right after she did that, she was arrested by the police and charged with providing state secrets to foreigners. The reality was they were newspaper clips. She was then sentenced to 8 years in jail, and she was released in 2005 before her jail sentence was done and exiled to America. The act of the Chinese government in singling her out, I find to be the most confusing thing of all of this, because the Uyghur movement, the Uyghur independence movement, the freedom movement, or the movement for Uyghur rights was a completely fractious group. It was not like the Tibetan group, which had its locus of authority focused on the Dalai Lama. And so the Uyghurs, basically, they had organizations in Europe, they had organizations in America, some organizations in Australia, and they were totally ununited. By the Chinese singling out Kadir, what they've done is they've given the Uyghurs a single locus. I mean, they've helped the Uyghur organizations overseas more than anything anyone could have done. By blaming Kadir, by saying she's the reason for these demonstrations, they've given the Uyghurs a leader. And I find that, of all the things that have happened in the last week, to be the most confusing. I can't really imagine why, when they had a Uyghur organization that they could have blamed, that the United States, like Chung Li has said, has signed on to and agreed with, is a terrorist organization, which is called the East Turkestan Independence Movement. And after 9/11, we agreed with the Chinese that that was indeed a terrorist movement, partly because we needed China's help in Afghanistan.
Well, I agree with what Zhang said. I was also surprised Chinese government actually put these two figures together. And this is actually the worst thing. They should actually try very hard to avoid. The worst thing for them is that all the forces united together. As we know that His Holiness Dalai Lama and Ms. Khadija are quite different people. His Holiness is a religious leader, spiritual leader. And also he tried very hard to reach with Chinese, talking about there's no hatred. It should not be hatred between Han Chinese and Tibetan people. And during the past few years, he reached out for Chinese communities overseas and also in China. But I don't know about what happened about Xinjiang, but again, that the Chinese leaders or Chinese official media put these two figures together. Mm. This tells us how poorly they understood the international community.
If I may, I respectfully disagree with both John and Cheng Li in part of what they've been saying. The Chinese government should not be blaming anyone, period, full stop. And we should not be surprised the events took place in Urumqi. I'm a little surprised of the scale of the incidents falling out, but not the way that the Uyghurs demanding their freedom that is guaranteed under both Chinese constitution and Chinese autonomy laws.
And you say their freedom, what do you mean?
Political freedom, social freedom, and cultural freedom.
Does that mean they want their own state?
The most pressing, paramount issue right now for the Uyghurs is to be able to live as Uyghurs. I think that's precisely the same thing that the Dalai Lama is asking for his people. The Uyghurs are losing out on all fronts. Cheng Li mentioned economic front, political front, and the cultural front. The Uyghurs today cannot be even a Muslim. But yet, internationally, Uyghurs been victimized. But
because
of their religion, people don't pay attention to their legitimate grievances, even if... For this reasons that I believe that is causing.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How much of the problem is religious? John Pumphrey.
That's a part of the problem. I don't think it's the main part of the problem. I think the main part of the problem is that the Uyghurs, like the Tibetans, are a border minority people, and they occupy a huge and strategically important part of China. That's a border province and also a province with strategic minerals and oil. I think that's the main and critical element. And the Chinese basically do not want this part to spin away. And specifically, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Chinese got religion and not Muslim religion, but they got religion and they realized that there but for the grace of God go us, and we've got to ensure that neither Tibet nor Xinjiang is ever going to spin away. So they really redoubled their efforts to encourage migration into the province by the Han, and they also redoubled their efforts to watch the Uyghurs because they didn't want to see any separatist movement. Jiang Zemin kept on talking about, he was the president at the time, nipping any type of separatist movements in the buds. And so I think there's a cultural difference between the Uyghurs and the Chinese, definitely a religious difference, of course. But other religious minorities in Chinese, for example, the Hui, have some relative freedom to practice their version of Islam. So I don't really think it's basically a religious issue at heart.
Go ahead, Nuri.
The Chinese government, the Uyghurs' religious identity and cultural identity is a stumbling block for further China's long-term strategic goals.
How so?
The Chinese government believed that Uyghurs' religious practice or spiritual identity is feeding tube to Uyghurs' ethno-nationalist identity that will lead to a separatist ideology in the future.
Do the Uyghurs have separatist aspirations?
The Uyghurs had very short-lived two republics in recent memory. First one is 1933, second one is 1944, and it is known as East Turkestan Republic. By witnessing all the oppressions and being subject to all types of cultural and racial discrimination, the Uyghurs had enough. That is one of the reasons that the Uyghurs took to the street last Sunday to demonstrate the demanding justice. But witnessing what is happening to the Tibetans, what China has been ignoring Dalai Lama's genuine offer to even live within the Chinese system, the Uyghurs not seeing any hopeful sign that the Chinese have a good intention to improve the lives of the non-Han Chinese population. So some Uyghurs rightly believe that the independence is the right way to go. But, of course, it's not it's not realistic approach given China's military and economic power. But the Uyghurs need to see some way to get out of this mess.
Let me understand from your perspective, and I'd like to hear the others as well. How are the Uyghurs being discriminated against within their province?
I can give you one example. In the United States, if any employer discriminate in a job applicant stating no female, no Uyghur, that person can be subject to a lawsuit. But in China, in Urumqi particularly, when you look at a typical job advertisement, it specifically said no Uyghur. And oftentimes the good jobs, well-paid jobs are given to the Han migrant Chinese, which Cheng Li was mentioning earlier, come to the region under the Chinese government-sponsored programs.
Well, a few things. I should say I disagree with my colleague here, Nuri. Because earlier he said that there's no allowed, you know, the religious practice, which is not true. And actually, I visited Xinjiang and Kashgar and Urumqi. You see so many religious believers, and they could still practice. Of course, we can say Chinese government should give more room, more, you know, freedom. It's still not enough. Now, in terms of the culture opportunities, it's a quite mixed feeling, which is true. He said that there's certain discrimination. But on the other hand, Chinese government also have some kind of affirmative action to give more, you know, a low grade to college admission and some job and etc. And also pass. Okay.
Cheng Li. Sure. He is at the Brookings Institution. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A reporter embeds with the National Guard unit as it prepares for war, deploys to Iraq, and returns home. He describes the challenges citizen soldiers face on the front lines and as they return to civilian life. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Joining us now is a spokesman with the Chinese Embassy here in Washington, Wang Baodong. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, hello to you, Diane. Good morning.
Good morning. And from your perspective, who was responsible for this current violence that we are seeing in northwestern China?
Yes, what took place in Urumqi, Xinjiang, Uyghur Autonomous Region is highly violent crimes, which involve beatings, smashing, looting, and arson, and even killing. And we believe that evident facts have fully shown that these are premeditated and organized crimes of violence again. And these crimes are directed and instigated by separatists abroad and organized and carried out by separatists inside China. But I mean, particularly there is this organization of the so-called the World Uyghur Congress, headed by the ethnic separatist Rubia Kadir. They actually made an issue of an incident in Guangdong province, and they just took this opportunity to staged these highly violent crimes.
Let me ask you, how many have died in the conflict?
Up to now, 156 people.
And do we know how many were Han and how many were Uyghur?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't gained the latest information on that because so many people, I mean, the dead, the dead's bodies were, I mean, abhorrently damaged, and some were burned. So some medical examination is still underway.
Let me ask you whether, considering the violence you've seen and the numbers of deaths involved, is the government of China reconsidering the grievances that the Uyghurs are discussing? For example, discrimination in employment.
Well, as to the, quote, Uyghur grievances, end quote, I should say that people should put this into a bigger context. There, I mean, for now, China is undergoing a special stage of development. On the one side, China, I mean, people in China enjoy their peaceful life and enjoy their opportunities of development. On the other side, there have been problems and challenges and complaint, not only from the minorities, but also from you know, ordinary people and the Han Chinese. So there, I should say that there are sporadic cases of injustice, okay, which minorities, including the Uyghurs, Uyghur Chinese, may be involved, but it's not I mean an exclusive phenomenon for the Uyghurs.
Let me ask you about President Hu Jintao, who cut short his stay in Italy. What action has he taken since returning to China?
Yes, so far as I know, he organized a meeting among the top Chinese leadership. He listened to some report by the Xinjiang Autonomous Region as to what has actually taken place, and he gave instructions as to what should be done now to to better handle the situation.
Like what?
Well, first of all, the relevant the various levels of governments in Xinjiang should put it as the first priority to maintain stability in the region to avoid further. Criminal activities.
All right. Wang Baodong, he is the spokesman at the Chinese embassy. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
Go ahead, Nuri.
It is. We've been discussing the discrimination issues here a while ago. The Chinese government even does not recognize that the Uyghurs have a legitimate grievances, as it can be indicated in the spokesperson's putting in a quotation mark. The Hu Jintao is returned, and the Hu Jintao does not have a very good record handling matters like this, as we have witnessed in the last several years. What the Chinese government need to do is to examine its minority policies, and it must acknowledge that it hasn't been worked. So by force, they're not going to achieve stability and ethnic unity in China. They
have what you're suggesting, Nuri, is that these kinds of clashes are going to continue.
I'm afraid so.
Would you agree with that?
Yes.
John?
I would. I think that it's all very well and good for us to tell China what it needs to do, but they're worried that if they do begin to allow significant autonomy and give autonomy back to the Uyghurs, to the Tibetans, if they change somehow their political system to also deal with significantly these sporadic grievances that Wang Baodong was speaking about, that the wheels will come off their authoritarian system, and that potentially the rule of the Communist Party will be challenged. Now, they have changed their political system to some degree over the last 20-some-odd years by allowing a lot more personal freedom. So 20-some-odd years ago, Chinese couldn't decide what type of job they wanted. They had to get permission to get married and divorce. They had to get permission to go overseas, etc. And now they have a much wider range of personal freedom. So that has changed. But in terms of political freedom, that's not changed. And what people like Nuri and the Dalai Lama are advocating is a real significant political loosening. And the Communist Party is very reluctant to get into that mess because they're worried about the future of their rule.
All right. Let's open the phone. Go to Randy. He's in Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I spent time in Xinjiang province, and I was a guest in both Han and Uyghur homes, and I'd just like to give you some of my observations. I think that a lot of what's been reported in the media about the problems between the Han and the Uyghurs is very true, but I don't think that everything can be explained in terms of ethnic hatred or discrimination, although certainly that's part of it, and I did personally hear a lot of slurs uttered by both sides. And I agree that the Han are certainly wealthier, and they have more material things, and it's also true the Han are moving to Xinjiang in droves because the Chinese cities to the east are very, very overcrowded, and they have intolerable air pollution, whereas in Xinjiang it's very sparsely populated, the air is still clean. And also something that hasn't been mentioned is that they are allowed to have more than one child in Xinjiang province. But I had very mixed feelings about what I saw, and I tried to compare it to the disparities that you see in the U.S. If somebody came to the U.S., they would observe that the majority of white people are wealthier than the majority of African Americans. And I think it's very facile to say, oh, that's all because of discrimination. But we know it's really much more complicated than that. It's also partly because of disparities in education and so on. And what I observed was that generally the Han are much more educated, and they certainly are aggressively entrepreneurial. So I left thinking that the key to peace and prosperity in the region is not separation from China, but more education and training programs for the Uyghurs so that they can share in the incredible wealth of the area. If you compare how the Uyghurs are living in China, they don't seem materially worse off than the Muslims in neighboring Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan, so I just don't see separatism as the way out of poverty for them.
Randy, thanks so much for your call. Nuri.
It's interesting that the caller drawing comparison between the blacks and whites in here. But in the United States, let's don't forget that the government does not encourage discrimination, whereas in China, the government, to the extent openly, this encourages discrimination, particularly in the hiring process in the workplace.
Chang, do you want to comment?
Again, it's a mixed situation. It's very complicated. On the one hand, they wanted to actually promote Uyghur leaders. Actually, during the past few years, now there's a law in the Chinese constitution in the minority regions, the number one person is the party boss, usually Han Chinese. Number two person is the government, like governors, county chief, etc., and mayors. They should be in the minority leaders. So the governor of Xinjiang actually is a minority, is a Uyghur. So that's the things try to enhance the minority leaders' participation. But someone said that this is the pro CCP leaders. But that's the effort. But you can say that it's still problematic. But they try to change that.
We're not talking about communist leadership. We're talking about ordinary people graduating from college with the same college degree, same credentials, applying for the same job. This particular Uyghur person that Chung Li is mentioning was handpicked, trained by the communist leadership in Beijing. That has nothing to do with the employment discrimination, racial discrimination we're talking about. This person, this individual, to the extent, much worse than this Han Chinese Communist Party chief. The way that he talks, the way that he implements policies, even makes policy recommendations, has nothing to do with ordinary Uyghur peoples.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Good morning, Bob.
Well, good morning. It's an interesting discussion. I'd just like to say, first of all, the Chinese ambassador there, he sounded like an American politician, the way he was answering questions and avoiding things and everything like that. And the other thing that I really wanted to say here is that this is a matter of discrimination. It's cultural discrimination. This isn't about who goes to college. This is about freedom to live your life the way you want to in China or in the U.S. There is discrimination on the part of the U.S. government towards blacks and towards American Indians still to this day in many regards in terms of policy. I'm not going to air that out right now, but I just want to say that the problem in China is the heavy-handed, authoritarian, communist government.
John, would you agree?
I think that his comments about Wang Baodong, the spokesman from the embassy, reflect something very interesting that's happening in China, which is the government indeed is becoming a lot more savvy in how it deals with the Western press, which is a perfect example. They brought and they've allowed 100-some-odd foreigners, including Shai Oster, to traipse around Urumqi in the midst of a significantly serious ethnic conflagration, which they've never done before.
I think we have to...
I was based in Beijing on two occasions. I was there during the Tiananmen Square crackdown. I was there from 1998 to 2004. You never got this kind of access. And I think that there has to be a bit of recognition that China has done something significantly important. Now, they're trying to get their story out. As to his second question, a second point, you know, the Chinese would say, look, we are a developing country, and if we turn into a democracy tomorrow, it's going to be more chaos than you've ever seen in your life. They look at Russia. They say, we don't want to go the Russian route. And they look at India. And to them, India is not a model. They don't want to be India, which has, as we know, a very unruly, but a very, to American eyes, a very vibrant democracy. But the Chinese Communist Party doesn't want that because they're worried about losing power completely. So, yes, their rule is authoritarian. restraint. It's heavy-handed. It is brutish. But at the same time, they have quadrupled their GDP in 15 years. They have indeed brought 200-some-odd million people out of poverty. They are now a global economic power, and people are looking at them, looking at this country, and saying it's going to emerge from the global economic crisis more powerful than ever. That is not a failure.
And I must say, 5 years ago, we would not have had a spokesperson from the Chinese embassy on the program. Go ahead, Nuri.
John was mentioning about the
and journalists. Not because we wouldn't have wanted, but because they wouldn't have wanted to come on. Go ahead.
I agree with John that the allowing the journalists access as we speak still in Urumqi is an amazing development. But initially, what I thought the Chinese government was planning to do is to show the burned cars and the messed up streets to the journalists to see this is what happened yesterday. But it turned out to work against the Chinese government's propaganda purposes when a group of Uyghur women, children and ladies took to the streets carrying their husbands and children's identification card and demanding their release. And the powerful images circulated all around the world have shown the true nature of the events fallout in Urumqi.
Well, I'm afraid that has to be the last word. Nuri, I hope you're wrong that the violence continues. I think the violence around the world is just ghastly, and this is getting worse. Nuri Turkel, he's an attorney, past president of the Uyghur American Association. Chung Lee is with the Brookings Institution. John Pomfret is with the Washington Post. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts.